This is Embodied on the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anisha Rao. How do you heal from losing a child before getting the chance to meet them? The answer to this question is told in the painful experiences of 1 in 100 pregnancies affected by stillbirth each year in the United States. Loss from a stillbirth can be isolating and hard to explain. But for some people, the best medicine is to break the silence, and that is true for my guest today. Andrea Lingle is an editor, staff writer, and lay theologian at the Missional Wisdom Foundation. She's also the author of Into a Reluctant Sunrise, a memoir. Andrea, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Of course. So you wrote your memoir as a way to process what happened to you and your family. And you acknowledge at the very beginning of that memoir something that I want to acknowledge now, which is that this is a heavy topic and not something that we have much practice talking about. And not something we have much practice asking people to share about. So I'd love to know what the story is that you want to tell, and maybe you could start us there.
It's uncomfortable, and it is difficult to. It's a difficult to articulate the story that you want to tell, because there's a lot of times when people start edging away or don't know what to do with the information. And that those people also include me. I don't know what to say about it, because part of the problem with losing a child before you meet them is that there aren't any memories to hang on to. There aren't very many stories to tell. The story that you have to tell is lost. But one of the things that I wanted to express when I wrote the book, and when I talk about it now, is that the lives that we don't get to meet still influence us in a pretty profound way. I'm different because of all my children, the ones that I have lived with for a while and the one that I didn't live with for very long.
You mentioned something there that I think is really interesting about grief and how, you know, when we lose people like a grandparent or even a parent, there are so many years of experience, so many layers of memories to hold on to, so many ways that person's story is brought up in everyday life, which is different for a child that only, you know, lived for minutes, maybe even less than that. So how was this grief different for you than the other kinds of grief you'd experienced before in your life? Is there a way to articulate that difference?
The way that I can articulate it most clearly is that there's a fear of losing your grief, because it's the only experience you have of that child. In losing grandparents, you're very sad, but the things that you talk about over and over are not that you're sad that they're gone, but how wonderful it was to learn to bake lefse from grandma. And every time we did it together, she would tell me how many corn cobs she had to put in her iron stove or whatever. And that is a treasure. But when you lose a child before they create memories and before you can tell stories, before they fall down and bump their knees, the only thing you have of them is grief. And so it feels like a betrayal as time goes by and you start to heal. It's a betrayal of the child, and it's a betrayal of you that you're losing your experience of them. So there's the initial grief of losing the child, and then there's the subsequent grief of losing your grief, because time is this terrible eraser of all things. And, you know, you do have to function, so that's a good thing. You know, I have to be a person in the world, and I can't continue to be immediately grieving for years and years and years. But there's a real sense of redoubled loss, because the child that you are grieving, there aren't any memories to fall back on.
So the daughter that you lost, you named Gwyneth, and this was your fourth child. You already had three other young little ones. How was your pregnancy with Gwyneth different from the ones before? And I mean, I know so many people have questions around stillbirth, like, did you have any signs, or was there any way to know, or is it just really random chance?
I mean, the fourth pregnancy was incredibly difficult. There was no medical There wasn't ever anything medical that flagged anything. It was just, I was exhausted. I was so exhausted. And also, Gwyneth was noticeably smaller than the rest of my kids. My first baby was born at almost 10 pounds, and the rest of them followed suit. And she was super tiny. So that was a concern, and we were measuring her, but she fell within normal limits. And it was more of a background question when I would go in for my appointments, but nothing ever cropped up as wrong. And when she was delivered, they took a look at her, and there was nothing visibly wrong with her. There was no cord accident. And we elected not to have an autopsy because it would have, honestly, because I couldn't handle that idea. I just couldn't handle it. So we don't know what happened, and that's really hard. And it's honestly harder for other people than it is for me, because it's to know why something happened, then you can avoid it. If I fell down the stairs and my baby died, then you would avoid walking down the stairs, or you would do so extremely carefully. But in this case, there was nothing. So it just remains a random event. And it is very difficult. It's very difficult to just not know.
I want to bring in another guest to the conversation now who has experienced both stillbirth and a miscarriage, two phases in pregnancy loss. And she tried to find community after those experiences and discovered similar silence to what Andrea discovered herself. Erica McAfee is the founder of Sisters in Loss and the host of Sisters in Loss podcast, also a doula and grief specialist. Erica, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So as you hear Andrea tell her story, what resonates for you in your own experience that you've had?
We share very similar experiences with experiencing a stillbirth, definitely having other children, and really navigating this grief and healing journey, and being able to help other women go through their journeys as well by in Andrea's case, writing a book, and then in my case, starting a podcast where I'm able to break that silence with storytelling and show people that there is success after loss. There can be healing after loss, and with how to navigate that grief journey.
So when you lost your son, Brandon Jr., can you kind of take me into what was going on for you in that moment in terms of some of the questions that Andrea raised about, you know, why, or why this time, or why me? I mean, I'm imagining it's so common to go through that in the early stages.
Absolutely. I think you question yourself, you question your body, you know, why did my body fail me? And then you really question just this existence of going through this entire pregnancy. In my case, I went through my pregnancy. I was 39 weeks and 5 days when I was induced and had my son. So, you know, I was like, you know, why did I go through this whole pregnancy that was very visible to my friends, my family, my coworkers, and then to not be able to bring a baby home? So you go through those questions in your mind in those first weeks, or really the first year after you've lost. And then you get to a place as you navigate the journey to really understand exactly what does it look like now? You know, how does this all affect me now? How would it affect me in the future? And then how do I navigate this journey with others? Because I can't do it alone.
How did the grief of losing a child compare to the other kinds of grieving that you had done before? Was it distinct for you as well?
It was very distinct. I think in my case, I lost my dad when I was younger. I was about 14 going into like my freshman year of high school. So what it really showed me is that losing a parent at such a young age, that I didn't really have time to really slow down and grieve his loss. Even going through all of high school and all of college and even post-college, getting married, the whole nine, it wasn't until I actually lost my son where I had, you know, 12 weeks of maternity leave to sit at home. You know, I couldn't go back to work because obviously I was full term. I had a C-section. and my body needed time to heal. So I actually had to grieve and go through the painful process of grieving the loss of my dad while bringing up all these newfound grief feelings with the loss of my son. So it was compounded, and it really made me realize that there is no way or no perfect path to grieving, and that you really have to do that hard work in order to find some sort of healing on the other side.
We're going to continue our conversation with Erica McAfee and Andrea Lingle after the break, and we'll talk about the effects of stillbirth on romantic partnerships, faith, and the physical body. Also, how doulas and others can support people through pregnancy loss. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is Embodied on The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao. The experience of a stillbirth, its pain and loss, is unique to every pregnant person, every couple, every family. There's a lot of cultural silence around the topic, but we're aiming to break through some of that today. I'm here with two women who've experienced stillbirth and share their stories publicly. They also hope to lift up the experiences of others in the process. Erica McAfee is a founder of Sisters in Loss and host of Sisters in Loss podcast. She's also a doula and grief specialist. Also with me is Andrea Lingle, an editor, staff writer, and lay theologian at the Missional Wisdom Foundation, also the author of Into a Reluctant Sunrise, a memoir. So, Andrea, I'd love to start where we left off talking about the physical body. And Erica mentioned, you know, you go through this process and you don't come home with a baby, but your body physically is still recovering from the childbirth, and there's still these physical manifestations of the pregnancy. So could you talk to me a bit about that and what it's like to experience that physically?
Honestly, that was one of the hardest parts. When you come home without a baby and you've delivered a baby anyway, your milk comes in, and it is incredibly painful. And when you're sent home with other things, you tend to get pain medication or, you know, interventions. I broke my foot last year and they put me in a walking boot or whatever, and I got a little knee scooter, and there was, you know, stuff to do. And for engorgement, there was nothing to do. You just had to kind of, you could take Tylenol, but everything hurt. I told my family, I said, I'm really sorry, but the air around me hurts. And it just felt so unfair. And then there was the rush of hormones, because one of the things that's wonderful about breastfeeding is that your body takes care of the need to be able to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning for a year. And so you are just absolutely driven by hormones to do this job. And unfortunately, even if there's no baby, you still have the urge to feed a baby. So there was pain in my body, and I was plagued with dreams. I had waking dreams and sleeping dreams of people dropping babies off for me to nourish. And that part felt really unfair. Like, I'd been through enough. I've lost my kid, and my body is really not, it's really not behaving right now, because what I really need is for everything just to pause and to realize that there's no imperative to follow here. But that was not my experience, and it was truly devastating.
Well, I mean, yeah, the world keeps going on. The world keeps ticking in ways that can feel so painful when you feel like everything is standing still like that. And I mean, Erica, for you and your husband, this would have been your first child. So talk to me about that, about the kind of going through those physical symptoms and also working through the grief in your relationship. How did you do that?
Absolutely. All the physical manifestation that Andrea described was the same for me. And, you know, having, you know, your breast milk come in, and, you know, having taken supplements and wearing, you know, cabbage to reduce the milk supply and stop it from actually continuing to produce and being engorged, all of those things definitely triggered me back into my grief. Every time I saw a baby or heard another baby's cry, my boobs would fill back up with milk. So it was, you really truly felt the physical manifestation of grief in your body, specifically for me, in the way my body was producing milk. And I had to really, work on those triggers that I was having around me and kind of take myself out and away from those things that were bringing me back to those deep, dark, painful moments. But as far as like my relationship is concerned, this was our first baby, our first year of marriage, and it tested us. Obviously, you know, everyone grieves differently. Everyone processes loss differently. And we really had to learn how to communicate with one another as we were navigating our own personal journeys of loss and trying to find some sort of understanding. And then once we were able to learn how to do that through therapy, we were able to come together and really support each other when we both were feeling down or feeling sad or just not feeling what this new normal was going to look like for us.
Is there, as you kind of began to work through that in your relationship, are there examples of conversations that you had either with your partner or with your therapist or with a family member that felt particularly healing, like a way that someone approached your story or approached talking about this that felt good for you in that moment?
Yes. What I realized after our loss is that a lot of our family members experienced loss as well, and they never talked about it. So it really opened a conversation with my paternal grandmother and my husband's paternal grandmother, who both experienced stillbirth and miscarriage. And it almost brought us closer together because in that generation, they never really shared those experiences. And they were able to share with us how they processed having lost babies and then continuing on to try again to have more children. My paternal grandmother ended up having 8 more children.
Wow.
And his paternal grandmother had 4 kids after losing babies. So I think that it helped us really navigate that journey, kind of rest assured that we kind of had proof that you can move forward, that you can try again when you're ready, but you really have to do it when you have a sense of healing.
Well, those are people who are so close to you who had never told you those stories, who had kept those silent. I mean, and that raises some questions, I guess, Andrea, about, you know, this is a lot more common than I think a lot of people realize, but we have so little practice talking about it, have so little space for sharing our stories. Were there people that came out of the woodwork for you who shared their experience or ways that you found healing through community?
Absolutely. My husband is on staff at a large member church in our area. And I remember standing in the hallways at church and just having people come up to me and start sharing their stories. And sometimes I had to stop them and ask them their name first because I hadn't met them yet. And it was a little bit like I had become a harbor, or at least a safe space for people to share. And that's heavy work. It's heavy work to be thrown into the position where you can relate to such a difficult thing. But it also, it helps with the loneliness because, like has already been said, your body was supposed to do a thing and it wasn't successful. Whether or not it was your body's fault doesn't matter. You carry the guilt and the shame of having been the life support system for a person and the person didn't make it. And it's really an unspeakable shame. And so to have other people come up and start talking about it at least gives you at least supports you that you're not alone. And but boy, is that hard work. It's really hard work to stay in there with people and listen to their stories and share your own story because it's heavy and it's hard.
Well, you mentioned being in a church because your husband is a pastor, which I think is a commonality between you and Erica. But I'm curious about that space in particular and the kinds of language around spirituality and faith where sometimes people say, you know, things happen for a reason or God has a plan for you. I mean, did any of that kind of language come up for you at that time? And was that something that you wanted to hear? Or how did this affect your relationship with your faith?
Oh, boy. Yes, it did come up for me. And no, it was not anything I wanted to hear. It also triggered an incomplete journey for me into becoming a theologian, because I really needed to answer the question, and I still do, how can you have a relationship with faith when you feel sort of a profound sense of abandonment that, you know, I had contracted with life and it didn't work out? And where does that put you? And quite frankly, it's been a rough journey for me, but it's been incredibly honest. There are no phrases or templates for the language that I use now for faith and spirituality. It has become a very honest and very deep search for me to find what can I claim to be beneath the words that people offer. Most of the time it's just good intentions, but if God has a plan, what does that mean? Or if everything works out for good, I don't like that one. That one hurts.
Yeah.
Because I almost don't want something good to come of this, because it was so hard and it was so senseless, and my baby had to bear the brunt of that. And if I needed to grow up or I needed to become better at something, there could have been some other way. It didn't need to be, she didn't need to sacrifice her life and her discovery and curiosity and all the ways that she could have enjoyed this world so that I could become a better thinker.
Well, Erica, I mean, as you hear Andrea talk about that, you know, there's so much, you know, rawness to the pain still, you know, 7 years on, and so much that both of you are still working through. And I know that you work as a doula. You sit with other people who are going through the birthing process, or sit with people who have lost a baby through the pregnancy process. So talk about that work and kind of what you do to support those women and people who are having babies.
Absolutely. A doula is a non-clinically trained support person who helps birthing people through pregnancy, labor and delivery, and in their postpartum period. And as a doula who supports birth and bereavement and postpartum, I come in and I support my clients, particularly the clients who come to me after they've experienced the loss and they're pregnant, or they're in that trying to conceive period where they are almost there, they're getting pregnant, and then once they're pregnant, we walk them through their pregnancy, their labor, delivery, and postpartum period. And then on the flip side, I see a lot of clients come to me who I get calls from the hospital who have experienced a loss, and they want to have a doula to come support them through their birthing process and then be able to say, you know, welcome the baby into the world, but also being able to say goodbye, how to provide them resources for like a funeral home, you know, if they want to cremate the baby, you know, helping just move and remove all that red tape that a lot of people may end up having, and hospitals may not be providing those resources to them. And, you know, being able to plug them into support groups, grief support groups, whether they're online or in person, and help them navigate what healing looks like for the next, 6 months to a year. So it's been a blessing to be able to give back to the community in this way and really do my own personal work where I'm working on myself, healing myself while healing others, helping to heal others.
Are there things that you found in working with families in those first few moments or hours after loss, rituals or things to do that can be really healing or later can really help anchor the healing experience for them?
Yes. So I am huge on creating memories for the client to make sure that they have those tangible things that they can hold in their hand and they can come back to later on. It's a little bit more difficult to do with a first trimester loss or even a second trimester loss, but we want to make sure that we are being able to, take pictures, have extra ultrasound photos, that, we are having those extra time with the babies. The clients are using a national service like Now Lay Me Down to Sleep, which provides photos of stillbirth babies. And then that we utilize like a cuddling cot or a carrying cradle where it sits in, can help preserve the life of the baby a little longer so they have more time to do all of those things that they want to do, whether it's a baptism or take additional pictures or do other prayers and rituals that's customary to them and their culture before they actually have to turn their baby back over to science or to a funeral home.
Andrea, I know that you had a funeral for Gwyneth and a public one, I think. People could come. Did you find that to be a helpful part of the process of saying bye to her?
I did. I think it was helpful. There's a vivid memory I have of a friend of mine who had also had a stillbirth. And as I was walking into the church before the funeral, I bumped into her and she couldn't really talk to me and I couldn't really talk to her, but she just held my hands and she said, "Thank you. This is something I never got." Hmm. And so as we celebrated Gwyneth's life, she celebrated her son's life. I have a lot of memories of the music that was played, and I was very careful to pick pieces that I found to be particularly beautiful. I was very proud of the way it went out, like you would be with you threw a nice birthday party for your kid, because it was the only thing we would ever get to do for her. We were all there. People showed up. People supported us. I'm pretty sure we had communion. I think I remember that. The rough part about grief that is so overwhelming, along with hormones and exhaustion and everything, is that your memories do get fuzzy, and that's really hard. The pictures that were taken were incredibly important, because unfortunately your memories do get really fuzzy, and it feels nice to be able to return to a little bit of clarity. But I did appreciate the funeral, and I'm glad we did it, even though it was a bit, it was overwhelming, but I'm glad we did it.
Erica, as these rituals are all parts of, saying goodbye, and you have this period of, postpartum experience, hopefully you're able to be at home for a while, but then you eventually go back to work. And we're going to continue this conversation after the break, but maybe if you could just start by talking a bit about the experience of going back into the working world after going through this experience.
Absolutely. Going back into the working world is difficult in any trimester when you experience the loss, especially when you begin to start showing and your coworkers know that you're pregnant. And being able to navigate that journey without getting upset every single day after coworker may come to you and ask you about the baby, thinking that you had the baby, but the baby's gone home to heaven. So we can really get into exactly what does that look like for people as they navigate that journey back to work, and how we can avoid being triggered every time someone talks about the baby and asks us about the baby.
Wonderful. We will continue that conversation after the break, speaking with Erica McAfee and Andrea Lingle. And we also want to note that this is part of our Embodied series, which is a series that is now also turned into a podcast. So if you want to hear more from Embodied, you can go and find it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. This particular conversation will continue in just a moment on the state of things. From North Carolina Public Radio, it's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is Embodied on the State of Things. I'm Anita Rao. As a society, we don't like to talk about our pain. It makes us uncomfortable. It feels awkward. But for the 1 in 100 people who experience stillbirth after the months-long journey through pregnancy, sharing stories can remind them that they are not alone and that their experiences matter. We're talking today with two women who have braved the discomfort and pain to share their stories of stillbirth and miscarriage. My guests are Erica McAfee, the founder of Sisters in Loss and the host of Sisters in Loss podcast. She's also a doula and grief specialist. And Andrea Lingle, editor, writer, and lay theologian at the Missional Wisdom Foundation, also the author of Into a Reluctant Sunrise, a memoir. So, Erica, maybe you could pick up where you left off of talking about going back to work and some things that I guess could help for those who don't have as much experience talking about this in terms of what to say or what not to say or the best way to kind of approach and hold space for those who are coming back after an experience like that.
Yes. So the best way to return to work and not be constantly triggered by coworkers who may not know what happened to the baby is to first seek your supervisor or your manager and have them do a lot of the groundwork for you before you return to work, especially if you know the date you're going back to work, that your supervisor either sends an email, a memo, or something out to alert the people that you work with and let them know that you've experienced the loss. Obviously, they've seen your baby grow, and for them to be kind and gentle with their words to you. The next thing would be to actually find a trusted confidant at work that's not your supervisor or manager, that you can have support you through your returning to work process, whether you're still lactating or if you're just really unsure how to navigate the journey. If someone does come to you and says something to you that may trigger you, that you can go to that trusted confidant and have that one-on-one talking to, and they can kind of encourage you to move forward with your focus and getting back to, the job at hand in which you are there to do. The third thing I would say that people should do is to make sure that they are seeing someone, whether it's a therapist or a counselor, prior to returning to work, because that's another person that is outside of the workspace that can help guide you on exactly what to do and how to navigate in your workplace from an outside perspective. And then the last thing is to make sure that you connect with a community, whether it's online or in person, and get real life experiences on a lot of people's journeys on how they navigated returning to work. Because every job situation is different. Things that people tolerate are different, but it allows you to get a better perspective on how to navigate different scenarios that may come up as you go back to work that first week, that first month, that first year after your loss.
Well, I mean, obviously there's no one way to handle this, kind of as you illuminated. And Andrea, for you, I mean, is it helpful for you to have people kind of awkwardly bring it up in some way if they don't know quite where to begin, or better to let you take the lead? Do you have any thoughts on that, starting the conversation or not?
Oh, gosh. 7 years out, there's not very many people that start a conversation because there are a lot of people that don't know that I've had this experience if they've just met me. So I found that the easiest way to navigate telling my story, obviously, is through writing. I spend a lot of time writing and sharing my story that way because I have such a hard time starting conversations. So then people who've read what I've written will have an easier time coming in. And then, you know, you just kind of let the storytelling open and unfold as it does. And what I find so helpful and so hard at the same time is when people ask about her name, because it's just not a name that we say very often just in the course of life. And so it feels so honoring of her and of me when people ask what her name was, and just let me practice saying it.
Erica, you started an online community for other Black women in particular after your own experience. And as we close out, maybe if you could just share kind of what the value of that space has been and what it has meant to create a space where other people can do just that, what Andrea said, kind of name the story and name the experience that they have had.
Yes, I believe that having a community is key to your healing from stillbirth. Having a place that you can go where people understand the pain that you've went through, and you can actually share your story openly, honestly, transparently, and be vulnerable to a group of women or men that you may not even know, and they get it. They understand. So being able to create an online space, particularly for Black women, with all the statistics out there on Black maternal mortality and infant mortality being so high in the U.S., has created a safe haven for women to come and really express themselves as they're navigating their grief and healing journey. But really, if they're going to try again and have more children, what does that process really look like? And how can I have support and encouragement from a group of people who understand exactly how to navigate that new and uncharted territory, but also know how it plays a role in their grief and their healing as they're pregnant after loss. So community has been so important for me. It has strengthened my personal journey in navigating grief, and it has opened up my eyes to a sense of you don't have to be in person to create community. You can create community virtually online as well.
Thank you so much to Erica McAfee, the founder of Sisters in Loss and host of Sisters in Loss podcast, and Andrea Lingle, editor, writer, and lay theologian, author of Into a Reluctant Sunrise, a memoir. Thank you both for sharing your stories and experiences.
Thank you.